Al Jazeera Podcasts.
A conflict with no end in sight, the war in Sudan is taking a heavy toll on civilians, with millions forced from their homes and on the verge of famine. What does it take to stop the humanitarian crisis, and can diplomacy stop the fighting? I'm James Bayes, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse, and help define major global stories. Well, we're bringing you deep knowledge of Sudan today with our guest contributors. In Kampala, Uganda, Hala Al-Karib is a Sudanese pro-democracy and feminist activist who's worked across the Horn of Africa for more than 20 years. She's the regional director of the Strategic Initiative for Women in the Horn of Africa Network. In Sudan, we're not revealing his exact location for security reasons. We have Duncan Riddell of the Norwegian Refugee Council. He's worked as a humanitarian in Darfur since 2011. Thank you both for joining me today to discuss the situation. Let me start with you, Hala. How bad would you say things are in Sudan?
It's extremely bad. It's devastating. I have heard and had conversations with many humanitarian and UN organizations. This is the worst humanitarian and human rights crisis that happened in Africa, over the past few decades. Extremely devastating, with millions of people are forced to leave their homes, and millions are exposed to atrocities and violence that it doesn't stop. According to UNICEF, we have over 20 million children below the age of 18 that they are not accessing education. 70% of the health facilities in the country are not functioning. And all the social service and public facilities in areas that are still under the control of Sudan armed forces are in a very miserable shape. Facilities and social service facilities under the RSF controlled areas are completely paralyzed and not functioning.
Hala, do we know the true death toll? I've been looking through trying to find estimates, and we don't, do we?
It's very difficult to exactly know the true death toll. For example, what we have heard tentatively that in regions like in West Darfur, the death toll could be easily between 10 to 15,000 people. Across Sudan, the numbers are speaking about, between 15 to 20,000 people. Because the truth of the matter that on daily basis, the number keeps accumulating. So I would say tentatively, trying to follow up on this situation and working on these situations, for the past 12 months, I would say easily there will be around 30 Sudanese people have lost their lives. 30 Sudanese civilians have lost their lives in this ugly, brutal campaign of atrocities that's happening.
Duncan, we had mentioned there of West Darfur. That's an area that you have worked in. And UN investigators say they believe there could be as many as 15,000 people killed in one massacre in Janina. That's also a place you've been to. Can you tell us what you know about that particular event?
Not talking about particular events, but what I will say is everyone that we encounter in our work in West Darfur and Janina have lost loved ones in this conflict. Friends and families have been killed in very brutal fashions. And everybody has been traumatized by the killings that have happened here. Like was said, it's very difficult to get estimations on the exact numbers. We're facing network challenges. There's limited network to communicate. Many people have been killed and buried in mass graves. So getting any accurate figure on the numbers killed has been very, very difficult. That's difficult for closure as well for those who are grieving. Many people who have had family and friends gone missing, likely killed, won't get the closure that they deserve because of this conflict.
Okay, let's just pause for a moment for a little bit of context of how we got to this point, a little potted history. 5 years ago, there were mass protests against the longtime leader Omar al-Bashir. He was ousted after more than three decades in power. Bashir was replaced by a civilian government, but that didn't last long. 2.5 years ago, the military once again seized power. General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan took control. But 1 year ago, there was a split in the armed forces. Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti, tried to seize power. His paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, have been fighting the army ever since. Hala, would you describe this as a civil war, or is it just a war between two men?
I think it's beyond the war between two men. I think it's a war against Sudanese people, and it's a war against civilians and against women and children. Our bodies has been used as a weapon of war since April 15. And that's what is happening until now. The fundamental dispute between Sudan Armed Forces and the Rapid Support Forces is manifests in a bloodbath and massive atrocities that's been happening against civilians, and so it's an extremely devastating situation because there is a lack of irresponsibility and care about the situation of Sudanese people, about the situation of civilians across the country. And it's very difficult, you know, to reduce what's happening in Sudan into a war between two belligerents. You know, this is way beyond that, considering the level of atrocities that are happening.
Duncan, you're dealing with ordinary Sudanese people every single day. How would you say the situation has evolved over this year?
What I would say is that through this war, the biggest victims are the civilian populations, especially in the peripheries of Darfur and South Kordofan, those areas of high conflict. These people have gone through a year of conflict, mostly in silence without international recognition or awareness. They have gone through losses. And now we are walking into a famine. So those that did not survive the conflict are also going into levels of starvation across the Darfurs. So I would want to say things are getting better, but they're not. Things are deteriorating quickly. And the people on the ground are the ones that are suffering from this war.
Hala, looking at this, as I've been trying to read as much as I can from afar, and obviously watching Al Jazeera's coverage of this, it seems like there was huge battles in the capital, which was laid waste. Then by the end of last year, the Rapid Support Forces seemed, I think, to have the upper hand. They seemed to be making gains and taking significant ground. But then, since the beginning of this year, am I right in thinking things have changed again?
I don't think there is significant change, that happened on the ground. We understand that Sudan Armed Forces are taking control of, large parts of Omdurman, part of the national capital. But beyond that, the situation remains the same. The situation in Jazeera, one of the most populous region in Sudan, and it's considered the breadbasket of the country, it's getting deteriorating every day. The RSF are moving one village to the other, looting and destroying farming communities that were not part, historically, they have not been part of any conflict. This is a very peaceful region. This is a region that provided refuge to millions of Sudanese you know, from Darfur, from Kordofan, from different parts of the country. And it's a region that fed the country. And this is one of the primary reasons why Sudan is very quickly sliding into a famine. So, you know, the destructions of, you know, of communities is ongoing. Also in Darfur, there have been numerous attacks on villages in western of Al-Fashir by the Arabic support forces. There is also numerous villages and farming communities in South Kordofan that has equally been under attack. And so those are all communities that has been feeding themselves and relying, you know, on themselves primarily. Right now, you know, they have been subjected to looting and killing and terrorizing and ultimately becoming displaced. So it's actually getting worse, in my view, the situation.
And Hala, one other factor, of course, in all of this is, and we have to work with the reports we have of this, is foreign involvement on both sides. Tell me what you know about that, because the Rapid Support Forces, there are allegations that the United Arab Emirates has been closely involved in supporting them, allegations that have been supported by reports to the United Nations, and now in, reports on the other side that Iranian drones are now being used by the Sudanese armed forces. There are other players. I mean, the Wagner Group, the Russian Wagner Group, apparently are there. There's even talks of Ukrainian forces on the other side and lots of other players. How worried are you about all of these other regional and international actors getting involved?
It's extremely worrying and extremely frightening that Sudan is turned into a battlefield between various global and regional actors. I mean, the affiliations between the Arabic support forces and the UAE is known in Sudan. The extortion of Sudan natural resources, particularly gold, you know, it's something that, you know, it's evidence that, you know, it's the UAE is one of the biggest markets. Having said that, you know, Sudan armed forces as well, prior to this war, has been equally involved in this. The campaign of militarization of Sudanese youth, young men of rural communities across Sudan, I consider also to be part of this problem. You know, Sudan has allowed, you know, its country and its young people to be utilized as fuel of wars in different parts of the region, and to be recruited and where, you know, recruitment and militarization is becoming a source of income, you know. So that's also another challenging element. And true, there is various confirmed reports. And I think, you know, if we are talking about, you know, a serious political process that will put an end to this atrocity, we need also to be serious about exerting pressure on actors who are fueling this war and causing this bloodshed and causing this killing and you know, and destruction.
Hala, I've been reading some of the human rights reports by Human Rights Organization and by the UN's Human Rights Office, and they are quite appalling, particularly the violence against women and girls.
This particular war, you know, using women bodies has been central in it from day one. And my organizations have documented the first sexual violence cases on April 15. Women has been primarily raped and sexually assaulted by the Rapid Support Forces throughout the past 12 months. But this is not new. The Rapid Support Forces and the former affiliated militia to them, the Janjaweed militia in Darfur, has been committing crimes against civilians and sexual violence for the past 20 years. You know, many of the Sudanese politicians and the international community has decided to, you know, following the indictment of Bashir, not to look into this, you know. So whatever is happening at the moment in across Sudan, you know, and this massive campaign of mass sexual violence, you know, it has its roots. The level of impunity, lack of consequences, you know, it normalized sexual violence against women and girls. And I would say it's appalling. It's horrific, you know, the scale of sexual violence that's happening. It's in my view, there is definitely a footprint of genocides, because sexual violence, you know, is also a genocide, particularly mass sexual violence. And most of the cases that were documented, they were gang rape cases. And gang rape, it means that this is not an opportunistic rape. This is a well-planned, you know, structured, systemic type of rape that's meant, you know, to use against civilians, to terrorize civilians, to lead them to leave their homes and leave their villages and cities and towns, and to break them. And unfortunately, this is what has been happening across Sudan. You know, women were raped in front of their parents. You know, mothers were raped in front of their children. Little girls were raped in front of their fathers. You know, sexual slavery is quite prevalent. Girls and young women were abducted and kept away for days. Many women, they have taken away their lives. And this is happening against lack of protection, complete lack of protections, lack of access to health services or any support. So it is only the civil society, only the frontline workers, you know, being the emergency rooms or grassroots women organization, are the one who were left to handle this horrific situation, which is beyond our capacity.
Well, this week, there has been a humanitarian donor conference taking place in Paris. Duncan, before this conference, global donors before this week had given just $155 million. That's just 6% of what was needed. I read an interesting comment by the NGO Save the Children that made the comparison that the amount of money raised until this week was less than a fifth than what had been pledged in 2 days to rebuild one of the landmark buildings in the city where the humanitarian donor conference was taking place, Notre Dame Cathedral, which, of course, burnt down in 2019. Yes, that's a wonderful building, but we're talking about a country of nearly 50 million people. Well, at this conference now, we believe they pledged, of course, they haven't come up and written the checks yet, but they pledged $2 billion. That's nowhere near what's needed still, is it?
That's exactly right. And I think it's wonderful that $2 billion has been pledged, but to remember, that's only 50% of the needed amount to be able to respond in Sudan for the incredible amount of needs on the ground here. And I wish we hadn't had to wait to the year anniversary of this awful conflict before holding the event for the governments to support the humanitarian efforts on the ground. And like you said, I think now the need is to translate those pledges to work on the ground to support the communities here, because they can't wait any longer. Humanitarian agencies have been raising the warning signs for the upcoming famine since November of last year. We don't have much time left. And so that $2 billion really, really needs to translate, not just to the easy to access areas, but also to those that are facing tremendous number of impediments to be able to access, like the Darfurs and like South Kordofan and Khartoum. Khartoum, which hasn't received any aid in 5 months, and the Darfurs, where recently the main border crossing for humanitarian aid, the approvals were revocated.
And your organisation, the one you work for, Duncan, is one of the few organisations that's still operating in Sudan. Many, many other organisations don't feel they're able to operate. I noticed a quote from one of your colleagues: only half of the G20 countries, those are the wealthiest countries on Earth, are contributing even after this Paris donor conference. What would be your message to those other countries around the world, not giving anything, saying, well, it's none of our business?
I think because the Sudan crisis has suffered in silence. There hasn't been enough attention drawn to it. The scale of the crisis that's ongoing here is unprecedented. It's the biggest displacement crisis in the world. And because it's flown under the radar for so long, I think there is a need for more attention, more funding. And I would request for them to look at the reports that are being written on of the needs. The scale of the malnutrition across the country, and I think that would be sufficient evidence to support this crisis here.
Hala, yes, we talk about malnutrition. We talk about famine looming. And I was looking at the official reports. There is this thing called the IPC, the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification. And they don't seem to really be able to get the data because of the security situation. And one of the things I was most shocked by, and Duncan mentioned it a moment ago, Sudan's a vast country and there is famine definitely in the country, but there is famine in the capital city.
Absolutely. You know, on my own neighborhoods, I get messages that children are unable to walk because of lack of food. You know, Khartoum, particularly Khartoum City, it's a city that's occupied by the Arab support forces. And they are the one who are in control of the food chain in and out of the capital, you know, of Khartoum City in particularly, and northern Khartoum or Khartoum Bahri. And those are the two locations where the suffering is really beyond imaginations. And that takes me to the issue of, you know, the importance of having, you know, some sort of protection strategy when it comes to providing humanitarian aid support. I think avoiding the conversations about protection and not to look at Sudan as a protection crisis will only exacerbate this crisis and will make it more difficult, because how can we get in humanitarian convoys into territories and areas where those convoys and those goods, humanitarian goods are subjected to be robbed or taken? I think both actors should have been held accountable, because this is a crime against humanity and, you know, violating the international law and, you know, starving civilians, innocent civilians and innocent children. It should be a crime. So I think, you know, the question of protections, the questions of, you know, serious consequences to this negligence and irresponsibilities and undermining of civilians' lives should be taken also as well seriously.
Duncan, you are dealing with people who don't have shelter, don't have food. Perhaps we can get your perspective now as we come to the end of the discussion, the message you'd like to send to people watching this.
I completely agree with Hilal that this is a protection crisis, and the amount of suffering that the populations in Sudan have gone through is really unspeakable. I visited Asaisa camp in central Darfur recently. The majority of the population there where the camp was attacked, everything from their shelters have been looted, the roof, their doors, their windows, and they are sleeping on the ground under the stars, and they're going to bed hungry. And I think it's important for the famine classification. However, I think it's a misunderstanding that people have already started dying in Darfur's due to starvation. MSF reported in Zamzam camp, a child dying every 2 hours. From my own experience, visiting the different communities across West and Central Darfur is the same, that we're seeing already people dying due to starvation, and we really need to improve access and scale funding to be able to support the community so that it doesn't deteriorate further.
Thank you very much to both of you, our guests today, Hala Al-Karib and Duncan Riddell. This episode was produced by Mohammed Al-Aishi, Fintan Monahan, Veronica Pedroza, and Jim Gilchrist. Studio sound was by Rinjith Kurian. The program was edited by Ahmed Adfaga, Zainab Bada, and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thanks for listening, and join me on Wednesday for our next edition.
Coming up on The Take, after a year of war in Sudan, what hopes and memories are people holding on to? That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.